this week, September 1st, 2015, on The Digital Story. Is the U.S. ready for the Canon EOS M3? Be kind to DSLR shooters. 39-megapixel JPEGs with the Sigma DP1 Quattro. And is Apple the most important camera company? All of this and more with yours truly, Derek Story, on The Digital Story. Welcome back to another Digital Story. I'm so happy to be here with you on this first week of September. Oh my gosh, summer is in our rearview mirror here, and we are headed full speed toward fall. Oh man, time does go by. Well, before I get into the news of the day, and boy, do I have some nice stories for you, I want to talk a little bit about a note that I received on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thedigitalstory, where we have all sorts of good things going on. And basically, a reader said, "Hey, Derek, I just wanted to remind you that those of us that shoot with DSLRs are just as passionate about photography and want the same level of respect as those that are nimble photographers in your audience." And I'm thinking, what's this about? And I go on and read, and basically what he's saying is that he's feeling like that sometimes in the comments, those that are shooting DSLRs are being viewed as dinosaurs or someone that's just not with the game. And he sort of resents that, and I don't blame him. And that's certainly not a message I want to come from me. And in fact, I know that I talk a lot about shooting with DSLRs because I still have my two Canon bodies and I still have lenses that go with them. And I still have situations where my DSLRs are absolutely the perfect tool for the job. So I just wanted to echo that sentiment in that, you know, when we're chatting away online and we're talking about gear in particular, that snide remarks of any type really are not appreciated. And especially against our brethren who are avid photographers and love their craft, but who happen to shoot with DSLRs instead of mirrorless cameras. Yes, you guys are full members of our virtual camera club, as am I, since I also shoot with a DSLR. You know, the one thing I've always liked about our virtual camera club is that I just feel like we operate at a little higher level than a lot of other places on the web. And I like that. And the same goes, the people that come to our workshops have all been top drawer and just really fun to work with. Generally speaking online, we have such a fantastic crew of people who participate on all the sites. And I really want to keep it that way. Thanks for writing, and thanks for reminding me about our DSLR brethren and all of us. Regardless of what you shoot with, and this includes iPhone shooters too, right? We don't want to be disparaging them either, especially after we see the 6S. We'll talk more about that in a bit. Anyway, for all of us, remember, we all love photography and we all deserve the respect from our peers. All right, so let's move on here. Let's do a little weekly update action, and then we'll roll into some of these fantastic feature stories that I have for you. The Weekly Update. Thinking outside the square. Support for landscape and portrait formats on Instagram. And this is from the Instagram blog. And they report, today we're excited to announce that in addition to square posts, and we're talking about format now, you can now share photos and videos in both portrait and landscape orientation on Instagram. Square format has been and always will be a part of who we are. That said, the visual story you're trying to tell should always come first, and we want to make it simple and fun for you to share moments just the way you want to. It turns out that nearly 1 in 5 photos or videos people post aren't in the square format. We know that that hasn't been easy to share this type of content on Instagram. First of all, I think this is good news. You're probably already familiar with it. The reason why I bring it up is I actually want to comment on it a bit. Right after this happened, I happened to have a shot that I wanted to put on Instagram that was in landscape format. And I go, oh, cool. All right. Landscape. Yay. I can, you know, try this out right away, which I did. It was a shot of a fountain and a a pond and some nice scenery that I had shot with the Sigma DP1 camera, which we'll talk about here in just a short while. And I was looking at the shot in the feed there, and I was going, it kind of lacks a little something. And what happened was, because I did put it in landscape format, it didn't really fill up the whole Instagram space, so to speak. And I felt like I was, you know, it was like too far back. I wanted to grab it by the edges and pull it close to me so I could get a better look at it. I think this is cool that we can do landscape and vertical shots. But I'll tell you, I probably will stick with square most of the time on Instagram. I actually like the square format. I fell in love with it back in the day when I was shooting with a Hasselblad. And I think square is cool. I like what Ansel Adams did with the square format when he shot Hasselblad Polaroids. And I just think in general, it's a neat format. But what I really think in terms of looking at Instagram shots on my iPhone is that the square fills up the space. And I just feel like there's a certain immediacy to those shots that I lose with the landscape and the portrait orientations. So anyway, the reason why I bring all this up is that love the new feature. So glad to have the option. I love options. But if you're an Instagram user, and I hope you are because it's really a lot of fun, don't automatically just put something in landscape or portrait format if you shot it that way originally. Take a look at the shot. Maybe try a version of it as a square and look at it and just think, which way am I going to have the most impact when I'm looking at it on a mobile device, such as a smartphone or a tablet or a phablet or whatever the heck you happen to be using, and more importantly, what everyone else is probably looking at it with. Because sometimes that square format just feels like it's just boom, right there. And I like boom, right there. In other news, Petapixel posts, the one thing Apple understands is photography. This was an interesting piece to me. I'll pick a paragraph here from the piece and then comment on it. Photos and video are the currency of social media. The iPhone prints this currency. There are better smartphone cameras, but not a better ecosystem. And if the rumors are true, the iPhone 6S will continue to trailblaze with a 12-megapixel camera, 4K video, and who knows what other behind-the-scenes improvements to its processing algorithm. Interesting, huh? The author goes on to say, traditional camera manufacturers can try to evolve, but they are at a distinct disadvantage by not being internet-enabled devices, which I think they should be. That's my suggestion. Imagine if your Nikon or Canon point-and-shoot could run Instagram and wirelessly connect to the internet. Would a material percentage of 2014's 1.5 billion smartphone purchasers choose these dedicated cameras? Very possibly enough to alter the downward growth trajectory. Okay, interesting piece here. So I really had mixed emotions when I saw this headline because, you know, what he's saying is the one thing that Apple understands is photography. As I'm sitting here smarting from no more aperture and no more iPhoto. And if they really understood photography, okay, this is just me being a brat right now, okay? If they really understood photography, then they would not end an application such as aperture and try to replace it with something as simple as Photos for OS X, right? I think what they really understand are consumer wants and needs. And I think in the area of photography, that's true. In the area of smart devices and all sorts of areas, I think they really understand what basic consumers want and need. It's a numbers game. And there certainly are a lot more casual snap shooters out there than there are serious enthusiasts. I would have said the one thing that Apple understands is consumer photography, not photography in general. So that's my first nit. Now, generally speaking, I like this piece. So I don't mean to tear into him here. I just wanted to clarify a little bit what I think, in my view, what Apple's really about here. Now, I think the iPhone is an excellent camera. I have an iPhone, as you probably know, and I love shooting with it. And I also love plugging other cameras into it, such as the DX01. And I love shooting with other cameras. And I love shooting with other cameras and having the pictures show up on my iPhone and just about every mix and match. And I think the point that the author hit right on the head was the ecosystem is what makes the iPhone. The ecosystem is definitely what makes photography interesting in the Apple world. And the fact that you can take a picture with your iPhone, your iPad, or load it into Photos for OS X and have that image appear on all those devices pretty darn quickly, that is neat. That is really cool. And then from there, of course, you can share wherever you want. And as we're looking down the sights of the announcement for the iPhone 6S, that's what we're calling it, which will be coming here in just a couple weeks, we're assuming, right? We don't know for sure, but we're pretty sure. Then we're probably going to see a nice upgrade to that camera. I love being on the S cycle because that's the cycle that usually gets the cool camera upgrades, and I anticipate that again. And I'm most definitely going to get the new iPhone, and I'm most definitely going to write about what the new camera can do, and I'm definitely going to have a lot of fun with it. But that is not going to affect my overall photography experience, my commercial work, or even my serious enthusiast work, the work that I do with mirrorless cameras and, oh yes, DSLRs. A fun piece in the sense that it kind of really gets you thinking maybe where you stand with Apple and the world of photography and consumer enthusiasts and professional photography and all that good stuff. I think, you know, he raises some good issues. Now, I have links to both pieces that I talk about in the weekly update in the show notes. And you should go if you're interested in these topics and read more about it and comment on those sites and get involved, because you know what? That's a lot of fun. And that is this week's weekly update. Story number one. Is the U.S. ready for the Canon EOS M3? Earlier this year, when Canon released the EOS M3 mirrorless camera in Europe and Asia, some wondered why not a worldwide rollout, including the United States. Well, in October, that changes. The EOS M3 is coming to the U.S. Now, the question is the U.S. ready for the M3? So, good question, right? So, the M3 is the third generation mirrorless camera body from Canon, uses an APS-C sensor, has some nice specifications in terms of megapixels. I believe it's up to 24 megapixels now. Good image quality. And it also has some shortcomings for basically a $700 body. Primary for me is that it has no viewfinder built in. I mean, it has the LCD screen, which is very nice, but it has no optical viewfinder built in, or it has no electronic viewfinder. And if you want an electronic viewfinder, it costs you another, I forget if it's $249 or $299, something like that. And then you have another thing to juggle. And I have one of those types of viewfinders for my Olympus pen back before the OMD came about. Yeah, in a pinch, I'm happy to have it. But, you know, generally speaking, it's just another item to lose in the bottom of your camera bag. Plus, there are still not a lot of native lenses for the M3. You can adapt your existing Canon lenses, and that's kind of cool. The one adapter, and then suddenly your lens collection is available. But a lot of those lenses are rather large, and so then you're kind of wondering, well, why not just put a DSLR on here instead of this mirrorless body? So there are a number of issues around the M3. That being said, see, it feels like I'm leading you towards that they shouldn't have released it in the U.S. And that's not where I'm going. I think they should. I'm glad they are. Because, I'll tell you why. Because a lot of Canon shooters, a lot of DSLR shooters right now, are interested in mirrorless, not as their primary way to shoot, but, you know, for those cases where they want to use maybe some of their Canon accessories and they want to carry a smaller body, and they want to have the mirrorless experience. So they want a mirrorless camera. And of course, the M3 has some nice things. It shoots excellent video. It has a microphone port on it. It has, you know, that great LCD. So it has a lot of really cool things. And they want the mirrorless experience, but they don't want to go to a whole new system. They don't want to go to Olympus, Panasonic, Sony, Samsung, Fujifilm. You know, they want to kind of stay home. They want to be able to use their existing flashes and flash accessories with their mirrorless body. And I think those folks will be interested in the M3 because it has evolved enough from the M1 to where I think it's a nice usable camera body. And since they already have lenses that they can adapt, then they're really looking at the kit that has the body and the kit lens. That's all you really need to start. Knowing that, okay, I got to buy the adapter, but if I do that, then I have my whole arsenal of lenses, plus all of my Canon speed lights and accessories. So I think for those folks, this makes sense. Now, I think for those of us that are hardcore mirrorless shooters, and I've never really confessed that about myself before, but right now in front of you, I am. I'm not interested in it. And, you know, of course, my DSLRs are Canon just because compared to what I can get with Olympus, Panasonic, Fujifilm, and Sony in particular, those bodies seem a lot more attractive to me than the M3 body. I'm not that guy that is a newbie to mirrorless and just wants something for certain situations, but basically relies on my DSLR kit. So the answer to the question is, in my opinion, yes, the US, and in particular Canon shooters in the US, they're probably ready for the M3, and I think a lot of them will enjoy it because overall I think it's a pretty darn good camera, just not a camera for the hardcore mirrorless shooters, yours truly included. Story number two, 39 megapixel JPEGs with the Sigma DP1 Quattro. So I got my hands on the DP1 Quattro, and this is the second DP1 that I've shot with. I have the DP1 Merrill, which is the previous model. I have the lens that works out to be, I believe, the 45 millimeter equivalent. On this one, I went for the lens that's the 28 millimeter equivalent. I wanted to have a little something different. And, you know, this is that oddly designed camera. You know, it's very long and the lens is off to one side and then the grip's on the other side and the battery goes in the grip. That camera, I'm sure you've seen pictures of it. And the specs are pretty good on it. It has as I mentioned, the DP1 has a 28 millimeter equivalent lens, maximum aperture of f2.8. 9 blades, 9 elements in 8 groups, and it has a 14-bit 19.6 megapixel X3 APS-C foveon sensor that captures this information using a 3-layer design. And obviously the foveon sensor is a different approach than the Bayer filter that most other cameras use, where they interpolate the color. And the foveon actually just captures the color, has 3 layers. Now, there's some discussion about, okay, what is the resolving power of this camera? When I write about it, I say that this is a 19.6 megapixel camera. The reason why I say that is because the RAW files in the native format are 19.6 megapixels. So to me, that is the actual resolution of the camera. However, you know, the way that the foveon sensor is designed, where it has these 3 layers, and the bottom 2 layers have additional resolution. I believe they're 10 megapixels each, something right around there. Sigma can leverage inside the camera a resolving power of 39 megapixels for its JPEGs if you want to shoot in that mode. And so I did. So I did this 2 different ways. I shot in the 39 megapixel JPEG mode. No RAW files on this. The RAW files are 19. And then I also shot RAW files at 19 megapixels. And then I used the in-camera RAW processing, which you can do for any of your RAW files, to make JPEGs from those RAW files at different resolutions, including that 39 megapixel resolution. I then took those 39 megapixel JPEGs and put them on my MacBook Pro Retina display and magnified them and looked at them closely, and they looked pretty darn good. So here now you have a file that measures 7,680 by 5,120 at 39.3 megapixels, sitting right there on your laptop from a camera that quite honestly is rather compact. Now, even though it has kind of that long style and the lens does protrude, it doesn't retract. I found that when I set it in my camera bag or whatever, if I set it on its back with the lens pointing up, because the height on it, it's not very tall. And so it fits almost anywhere. It's just like basically sitting a strip of magnesium alloy just down in your bag there. It's very light. When I put the neck strap on it and carried it around on my neck, it was really light, very comfortable. If I put it over the shoulder, it was even lighter. Because of its width, it carries really well on a neck strap. It doesn't bounce around a whole lot. Those interesting RAW files are a hoot when you process them in the Sigma Pro Photo application, which is slow. This is a slow application, but it really takes those RAW files and have a real film-like quality to them. They really do look like film. So this is a trippy camera. Now, here's the thing about it. It's a $999 camera. You have a fixed focal length lens. You can pick the wide one, which is 21 millimeters. That's the DP0. The DP1, 28 millimeters. There's one right around 50 millimeters, and then there's one at 75 millimeters, the DP3. So, I mean, you're picking one camera with a lens. The lens is, you know, matched to the sensor in the system. You have a slow workflow because you can't process the RAW files with Lightroom or Aperture or Capture One or DxO or any of those others. You've got to use the Sigma Pro for those RAW files. But a fun thing to do, and what I did was I shot RAW plus JPEG. I used OnOne's Perfect Browser to rate the images, and then when I found a JPEG I really liked, then I would take that RAW file, its companion RAW file, and open that up in Pro Photo and then process it there. And that worked out pretty well. It's a camera for people who love to shoot landscapes, who possibly are interested in cityscapes and architecture, who want a different look that they can't get with, you know, the cameras that we normally talk about. And then who on occasion would want these really large JPEGs too, these 39 megapixel JPEGs for immediate use or, you know, for printing or whatever. It's just a camera that marches to its own drum. There's no Wi-Fi, there's no NFC, there's no pop-up flash. An optical viewfinder is available for it, but it's separate. It's $249. It's just different. But I think for the right person, someone that really wants a different look to their images, and someone that really likes the look of film but doesn't want to shoot film, then I think this camera is interesting. It's never going to be a top seller, right? Because, I mean, this is the opposite of what we were talking about with Apple earlier. You know, Apple designs the iPhone and the ecosystem surrounding the iPhone for the consumer. Sigma is designing the DP1, the Quattro, for a very small niche, a photographer who wants something different, unique, special, who doesn't really care how long it takes to produce the image, just wants a different kind of image. So anyway, interesting camera. I'm glad I got to shoot with it. I must admit, I liked it. I just wish it fit into my workflow a little bit better. All right, let's take a stroll over to the screening room this week. All right, for those of you that like the Google ecosystem, probably haven't been feeling a lot of love lately. I'm sorry. I have a title for you. I do have a little love for you. It's Up and Running with Google Photos with Nick Brazzi. And Nick likes Google Photos, and he will show you what you need to know to leverage, really what's a pretty neat service. And with a lot of storage space and a lot of connectivity and some nice apps, there's a lot of stuff going for it. Nick will show you all of that in his title, Up and Running with Google Photos. You can check it out on lynda.com. And if you go to our landing page, lynda.com/thedigitalstory, you'll find out that you can start your 7-day free trial there. You can watch all of Nick's movies plus every other title in the library. This week's screening room selection is Up and Running with Google Photos. Yes, Google photographers, we're showing you a little love this week. Story number 4. This will be a quickie too. Mastering the Olympus OMD EM5 Mark II, the manual. So, the folks that I work with, Rocky Nook, I've been waiting for this manual to come out. And this manual, this is a 528-page guide. It's by Daryl Young and James Johnson, and basically delves into every nook and cranny in the OMD EM5 Mark II. And believe me, there are a lot of nooks and crannies to explore there. And so I have it. I have the PDF, which is what we're talking about right now, the ebook. And I make sure that it's available on my iPad, so I'm in the field, I can look things up, or if I just have some time to kill, learn a new feature of the camera. So I told them I wanted to feature this, and I said, could we have a discount code? And they said, but of course. And so I have a 40% off discount code for you, and that code is OMDM540. OMDM540. And all you gotta do is go to rockynook.com, go to the catalog page for that book, order it. I think it's $39 normal price. Enter the discount code, you'll get 40% off that price. And if you're an EM5 Mark II shooter, I think you're gonna like this book. Now, here's a little piece of trivia for you. Yes, this story has a little wrinkle to it. There are 2 photos in that book by yours truly. Yep, chapter openers. So keep your eyes peeled and see if you can spot which ones are mine without actually looking at the bottom where the credit is. And see if you can figure out, okay, that looks like something that Derek would shoot. Okay, anyway, so I have 2 shots in there. Just did it out of the goodness of my heart because I wanted this book to look sharp, and they were asking for a little help with the images. So anyway, that is a nice little tip. 528-page manual. I can get you 40% off by using discount code OMDM540 at rockynook.com. Okay, let's take care of a little virtual camera club business. I have a notice from Red River Paper about 60-pound Pecos River gloss. And it looks like they're discontinuing it. So here's what the notice says. For years, 60-pound Pecos River gloss has been the best choice for glossy inkjet printable cardstock. Its smooth glossy surface and plain paper back make it uniquely suited for printing greeting, note, and thank you cards. Due to issues with the source paper mill, base stock, and coating inconsistency, we have chosen to discontinue 60-pound Pecos River gloss. We feel you deserve the best in terms of quality and consistency. Therefore, the current stock of Pecos River gloss will be the last available. Because it's such an important product, however, they have a replacement on the way. So I'm talking about this for 2 reasons. The first reason being, if you like that stock, I wanted you to know why you won't be able to find it here pretty soon. And then the second reason being that I really respect Red River Paper, and I respect their attention to detail and quality. And when they started running into problems with the stock and they could not resolve it with the mill, they did the unpopular thing, really, which is discontinuing it because a lot of folks like it. And then they're going to have to find something to replace it with. And that's the kind of folks they are. They have a tile in all the pages of the Digital Story, Red River Paper. And you can go there and they have, except for Pecos River Gloss, they have just about every stock and size imaginable that you would need for your inkjet printing. And they have a terrific Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper. They are the people looking out for your inkjet prints, and they try to do so at the best price possible. And longest running sponsor of the Digital Story. I have an interesting sizzle picks anecdote for you. So I was over at a friend's place the other day, and he had been doing some remodeling. And he had this nice space in his bathroom where he wanted to put one of his shots. So he's going, you know, the bathroom gets closed up, shower goes on, it's humid. Just really never had very good luck putting any pictures in here. And he did not know about sizzle picks, which means he doesn't listen to the podcast, which is another issue altogether, but I chose not to address that with him. Anyway, I try to take the high road. I do. Anyway, so I told him, I said, you should really look into sizzle picks, because the cool thing about this is that you can have this terrific image, and a 16-inch sizzle picks would look great in the spot that he had. You can hang this up in here. You can have a terrific image. It'll look great. You can really finish off the design of your bathroom here, and you don't have to worry about it. And in fact, if anything splashes or spills on it, or, you know, someone goes crazy in the shower and they, you know, shoot shampoo over the top and it lands on your image, no worries. You just wipe it off with a soft cloth and it's as good as new. It won't harm it at all. And that's just kind of another interesting use in that you can put them in places that you can't put other stuff. And you could probably hang them in a bright area and not have to worry about them fading the same way that you do, at least not at the same speed that you do with a regular print. You can put them in humid environments. You can really stick them just about anywhere. And I think that's a really nice thing. And wouldn't it be cool to have, you know, a really nice, I know you didn't expect for us to be talking bathrooms today on the show, but fact of the matter is we do spend some time in there, and wouldn't it be nice to have a really nice image to finish off your bathroom design? If I could have thought of another really humid environment, or if this anecdote hadn't really happened, I probably would have used another example. I'm just saying, you get the idea. Sizzle Picks, SizzlePix.com. They have a tile on all the pages of the Digital Story. These guys are artists, and what they can do with your work is amazing. Give them a chance. Order something today. And regardless of which room you put it in, believe me, people will comment on your shot. All right, let's see what's going on here. I think that's going to do it. Just a reminder, if you're ordering through B&H or Amazon, please click on the respective add tile under the products header in the box halfway down the second column of the digitalstory.com. That helps support the site. And I will see you next week. I think I have a big announcement next week. So stay tuned. I think September is going to be a very active month for us. So make sure you hang out. Tell your friends to listen to the show, you know, do them a favor and do us all a favor. Get them hooked on this, and let's make this virtual camera club grow even more. Until next week, have a great week. Take some wonderful pictures. Bye-bye now.